If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host, and this is the final episode of season two. Don't worry, it's not the final episode of the entire series, just this season. We're going to take a break for the holidays, and then we'll be hard at work putting together the content for season three. Season three, as I've said before, is going to be completely devoted to wolves and wolf reintroduction in the U.S. and the many law enforcement cases that have resulted. But we're going to do a deeper dive into wolves, and you're going to learn about the ecology of wolves, their place in the environment, and their impact on both people and their prey species. You'll be hearing from some of the best law enforcement officers in the country who've worked on law enforcement cases, but also some of the most knowledgeable wolf biologists and ecologists in the world. So if you haven't signed up on the website already and subscribed, make sure you do that, because that way you'll get notices about the upcoming season three and other extras that happen along the way. Couple of things I want to go over before we introduce today's guest. One is the votes are in from my previous request for votes about my mustache, and it's a unanimous keeper. I'm keeping it. My fans want me to keep the mustache, so it's happening. Soon I'm going to add a reading list to the website, so if you're interested in more information about wildlife trafficking and law enforcement cases, you'll be able to go to the website, and there'll be a long list of books that have been written about different wildlife crime cases, wildlife trafficking cases, all of them read by me, so they've been vetted as good books. Okay, I've got three great guests with me today. These are three gentlemen I've known for years. I worked with professionally while I was a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And unlike previous guests that have been law enforcement officers for the most part, today we actually have three federal prosecutors, three assistant United States attorneys who work for the United States Attorney for the Central District of California. I've got with me Mark Williams, who is the chief of the Environmental Crimes and Consumer Protection Division at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles. Also, Dennis Mitchell, who's an assistant United States attorney in the Environmental Crimes section. And Matt O'Brien, who's also an assistant U.S. attorney in the Environmental Crimes section. Guys, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. I've been looking forward to this. It's a huge honor to have you guys here.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We're honored to do it.
Thanks for having us, Ed.
Yeah.
It's going to be a fun discussion. If you know how we structure this, this is a conversation between people who've done the job, right? Who've worked together and know each other well. If you slip into using acronyms that my audience might not know, I'll make sure we back up and we talk about what those acronyms mean.
We love acronyms.
We love acronyms in the federal government, that's for sure. So I think what I want to start with is there's often a lot of confusion among the general public, I think, about the difference between, you know, a district attorney or a state prosecutor versus a federal prosecutor. And then also some confusion about what's the difference between a U.S. attorney and Department of Justice attorneys. So Mark, since you're the chief of the unit here in Los Angeles, can you explain to my listeners a little bit about what is it the United States Attorney's Office does and how does it relate to DOJ in Washington, D.C.?
Sure. Sounds good. So just big picture, assisting United States attorneys, or AUSAs as we're called, are basically federal prosecutors. We enforce federal law, big picture. The DA is the same thing, but at the state level. So the DA is employed by the county district attorney in Los Angeles County. That's a really big office across the street from us. But they enforce state law. We do felonies and misdemeanors in our office. The DA kind of does the same thing on the state side. We're all on the federal side under the Department of Justice, or DOJ. So the Attorney General is the head of the Department of Justice, and they have attorneys back in Washington, D.C. as well that work on different types of cases ranging from terrorism or wildlife crimes or violent crimes. And then each district in the United States has its own U.S. Attorney's Office. So in California, there's a central district, which is headquartered in Los Angeles, but encompasses San Luis Obispo County, Ventura County, Orange County, San Bernardino County, big area. Then right. you have the Southern District in San Diego, you have the Northern District in San Francisco, and then you have the Eastern District. And then each state is kind of the same. They have one or more districts in each state that's headed by a U.S. attorney. Our U.S. attorney, as the others are appointed by the president, right. so they can change from administration to administration, but the mission is essentially still the same. We enforce federal law, we prosecute federal crimes.
And how does that relate to when sometimes you hear about DOJ in Washington, D.C.? Because I know Department of Justice does have an environmental crimes section. So how do you guys work together? You've got an environmental crimes section here in L.A., but there's an environmental crimes section in Washington, D.C. too at DOJ.
Yeah.
How's that work?
So DOJ's environmental crimes section, known as ECS, they have the ability to work cases nationwide. So they could work a case in Iowa, they could work a case in Florida, they could work a case here in Los Angeles and partner with us. Not every U.S. attorney's office has an environmental crime section like we do. We're pretty specialized in our ability to do that because of where we're situated. With the ocean here and all the national forest land and everything, it's become a priority to work these cases out here. But really, because we have our own section out here, we'll partner with ECS. But they won't do cases by themselves out here. You know, if there's a case maybe in Idaho or Montana, ECS would come in and handle that case. If it's a wolf poaching case or something like that, out here, the attorneys in our section do all those cases ourselves.
Right. And, you know, I came to Los Angeles as a federal agent in spring of 2003 after I got out of the academy. And it was such a treat to be a wildlife federal agent in Central District of California, mainly, who had access to an environmental crime section. Like you said, not every United States attorney's office around the country has one.
Most of them don't.
Most of them don't.
The great majority do not.
Yeah, Dennis, I mean, I think Miami maybe does, but it might only be one prosecutor.
Yeah, what you typically will have is in some of the districts at the U.S. attorney's office, there'll be one prosecutor, maybe two, who specialize in environmental crimes and in wildlife crimes. But typically, there's not a section. It's extremely unusual to have a devoted section to that area of enforcement.
It's super lucky because it has been maintained in Los Angeles, regardless of what administration is in power in Washington, D.C., which is great. You know, wildlife crime in particular, but I think environmental crime in general is a pretty bipartisan issue. I mean, people are opposed to it on a bipartisan basis. So that's great. And it was always a great tool because to explain to listeners, if you are in a district where a United States attorney does not have an environmental crime section, then if you're a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agent, and you have a case, you have to take it to general crimes at whatever U.S. attorney's office. And there you're competing with FBI agents who have bank robbery cases, terrorism cases, DEA agents who have drug cases, ATF agents who have gun cases. And so you're often trying to sell your case it was great to be able to come to you guys.
It's a good point, Ed. And I think it works both ways though. I think the only reason we have a section is because we had great agents and have great agents like you who've done undercover work, you know, on the proactive side, who monitor the ports, who monitor, you know, things coming in and out of the district. We've had great relationships with Fish and Wildlife Service over the years, and different agencies. And so we only can really do the work we do because we have agents like you out there kind of originating these cases and catching the bad guys. So it does work both ways as a partnership.
Well, I'll tell you a secret. when I was an agent in LA, I was always told by my superiors, don't F up the relationship with the U.S. Attorney's Office. That's what we were told. Only take them great cases.
That's great.
And don't piss them off because we need that good relationship with our prosecutors. And that was drilled into me from the very first day. It was told to me, I think, on my first week, we have a great relationship with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Don't F it up. over the years, you guys have handled some of the best cases done in the country related to wildlife trafficking, wildlife crime. And I want to ask each of you to kind of reminisce a little bit about maybe your favorite case or two. And Matt, I'm going to start with you because you haven't said anything yet. I don't want to put you on the spot, but have you thought about any of the cases that kind of stood out for you working in this unit?
Sure. One of my favorite cases was you were a big help on, and it was a plant smuggler.
Okay, time out. Just so you know, you guys don't have to talk about cases you did with me. I just want you to know.
I thought that was required. That's the whole purpose of this.
I'll go on anyway.
Okay.
Anyway, so these guys were, they were Koreans. And in Korea, there's on the black market, there's a huge demand for Dudleya plants, which are kind of small succulent plants that take forever to grow in nurseries. So there's a premium on Dudleya plants that are taken from the wild. And so these guys would fly in from Korea to California and go up to real remote state parks up in Northern California, typically right on the coast, which is where the succulent plants grow. They would rip out of the ground live plants, thousands of plants, drive them back to their nursery in San Diego, and then bring them up here to Compton and export them to Korea. And so working closely with the state California Department of Fish and Wildlife, they were caught with, again, thousands of these plants at the export company in Compton. They're basically caught red-handed. The state brought charges, the district attorney up in Del Norte County, and then we also brought federal charges against them. Right after we did, two of them, who we had been led to believe didn't have passports because the state, the DA had seized their passports, went to the Korean embassy and said they had lost their passports and got new ones. Mm-hmm. So they then fled on foot to Tijuana to escape the federal case, and they succeeded. They flew, got on the first flight out of Tijuana back to Korea, I think through China. So we thought we were kind of out of luck. We had caught one of them, but he was kind of the low-hanging, the least culpable guy. And then where you came in was just kind of by luck. The main guy, whose name was Byung-Soo Kim, was caught in South Africa doing the same exact thing. Mm-hmm. Basically the same thing, stealing live plants from state parks or national parks in South Africa, trying to smuggle them back to Korea. And just by luck, you were the Fish and Wildlife Service's attaché in South Africa at the time.
Right.
We were able to extradite him to the U.S., which is a lot of work, as you know, and we never could have done it without your help and the help of the South African prosecutors. So the guy spent about a year in kind of a notorious South African prison awaiting extradition. Then we brought him back here. He was sentenced to, I think, 2 years in federal prison.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was actually brought up to Del Norte County, where they'd been waiting patiently for him all this time.
Right.
And he was sentenced up there.
I think he got a few years up there, too.
I think so. So it was just the case had a lot of ups and downs, obviously, but I thought it was a great example of us working with local partners up in Northern California and then working with the South African prosecutors to nab this guy.
Yeah, I agree. I also enjoyed that case for the same reasons. But is that what really you liked about that case, was just the interagency cooperation, or was it the plants that you liked so much about it?
Well, I mean, both. I didn't know anything about these Dudleya plants before the
I didn't
case.
Either.
But it was horrible. They would just go to like a coastal bluff and rip out thousands of plants. And these plants take a long time to grow in the wild. So the destruction they were causing in these beautiful state parks up north was terrible. And I think after the state wardens seized the plants, I think they were actually able to replant them in the wild. So I'm sure not all of them survived, but that was a great result.
Yeah, that was a cool result. And, Savannah Morgan was the state game warden who worked on that, and she was a guest during season one and told her side of the story. So it's great to have you telling the prosecution side. One thing I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that the defendant, he was a guy named Byung-Soo Kim. He was charged in state court and federal. How does that work when, how is it that the feds can also charge somebody that's been charged in state court?
Well, it doesn't happen all the time, but typically we will consider federal charges against someone who's already been charged in state court if the kind of the nature of the federal crime is different.
Got it.
So I don't recall specifically what the state charges were, but I think it was just violating state law that says you can't rip out plants out of state parks.
Right.
When we were presented with the case, it was as a violation of the federal Lacey Act, which is a different crime. The nature of that crime was that they were taking plants that had been basically stolen in violation of state law and then trying to export them out of the country.
Right.
So because our focus was on the attempted export of these plants, it was a different crime. And that's a situation where we'll step in and charge federally, even though there's a pre-existing state case.
You know, I'm interested to see what all three of you guys think about this, but I've always viewed that as the place where the federal government can really help the states, right? So if somebody does something illegal in violation of state law, whether it's a wildlife crime or stealing a car, and they move it across state lines, it's very difficult for states to like work those cases outside their jurisdiction. But of course, the federal government has nationwide jurisdiction and a lot of international resources. So that Lacey Act triggering allows the federal government to come in and really help the state stop this kind of crime by bringing the power of the federal government and federal legislation to it. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Did you see it in that way? Like, we're charging a federal crime, but this is a way for us to really help the state protect its resources.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And often at the state level, the penalties for environmental crimes are very low.
Mm.
Whereas in a federal case, if there's a lot of money at stake, even in a kind of a wildlife or plant context, the penalties can be more severe. In our case, it was the state game wardens who had done 95% of the investigatory work. They did had done an incredible job surveilling these guys up and down the state. Just incredible, probably the best surveillance I've ever seen in a case.
They're good.
But once we've caught the Byung-Soo Kim in South Africa, I thought that was another instance where the federal government really has resources to get this guy back. The state is able to extradite folks, but it's a lot easier for the feds to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was happy that we could play a role in supporting the state case by kind of handling the extradition.
Mark and Dennis, you kind of agree with that feds can benefit state enforcement?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other piece of it, Ed, is sometimes you'll have a wildlife trafficker or smuggler who's dealing in rhino horn or other things, but they're also committing tax fraud.
Right.
They're also laundering money. Those are things that the federal government has jurisdiction over, and the penalties are stiff. You know, if you indict somebody for tax fraud or money laundering, they're going to prison for a long time.
Right.
And federally, they serve all of their prison sentence. There's no parole. They can get credit to get out a little bit early, but you're only cutting maybe 20%. They'll serve usually at least 80% of their sentence.
Yeah.
On the state side, they go to prison, and it can be for a short period of time, low months, even though they're sentenced to like 3 or 4 years.
Right, right.
So when we come in against these serious offenders like the Dudley smuggler, who's traveling internationally and involving multiple countries and states, we're using our resources to really put away, some of the heaviest traffickers in the country. And the state doesn't always have the capacity or the ability to do that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you have anything?
It's a good point. And the minute you have interstate trafficking, our jurisdiction kicks in.
Right.
So we look for that. And so a case might not go federal if everything was taking place within the state. Because some of those statutes, it depends on the interstate commerce connection,
which we're
usually able to establish.
And international, of course, triggers smuggling, which is a serious felony, right?
That's a
very serious felony.
Per se, right.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'll tell you just before we get to Dennis and Mark's favorite cases, I'll tell you just some funny anecdotes or background. You mentioned that you worked real, you know, you're real happy with how you worked with the foreign prosecutors in South Africa on that case. And just so my listeners know, starting in 2012, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service started basing special agents overseas. I think there were about, at its height, there were about 12 of them based overseas. And their job really was to provide that kind of liaison work with foreign countries on law enforcement. I happened to be in South Africa. Byung Soo Kim jumps bail, basically, goes into Mexico and flees. Now there's a warrant for him in the U.S. And my colleague, Erin Dean, here in L.A., had just remembered off the top of her head that at some point they found a document in one of these guys' luggage or on his person that referenced a plant nursery in Cape Town, South Africa. Wow. So she just called me, long distance, says, have you ever heard of this nursery? And I said, nope, never heard of it, but tell me about this case. So she tells me about it. And I said, you know, there's only three, maybe four places in the world that these plants are found. He knows he can't go back to the States now because he's got a warrant. He's going to come here. So I went and I briefed the South African police. I said, here's what happened in the States. This guy's probably coming here. You might want to be on the lookout. And I thought, oh, I'll never hear about this again, right? And I swear, 10 days later, the South African police colonel in Cape Town gets a hold of me and says, hey, we just got your guy. And he had $1 million worth of succulents in his hotel room when we did a search warrant. Wow. So that's super cool, right? But where it got even cooler was they wanted to prosecute him in South Africa and we wanted to extradite him. But the first thing that I did was I reached out to the prosecutor in South Africa and said, how can we help you make your case first? Right? So they ended up making a great case against him. They got the highest monetary penalty ever for any kind of plant case in the history of South Africa on that case. And because we cooperated with them, they were more than happy to help us get him extradited. And because of that, I remember I used to have meetings with the Homeland Security attaché and the FBI attaché, or the LEGAT, regularly in Pretoria. And the FBI LEGAT was trying to get a drug smuggler extradited from South Africa. And she'd been trying for about a year and a half and she couldn't get it done. And how long it took us, like 6 months to get this guy extradited from South Africa, right?
Thanks to you.
Well, I think it was really thanks to all of us, because you were very cooperative with the South Africans as well, right? We didn't come in as Americans who were trying to say, you need to do this for us. We kind of came in with, how can we help you? And when we're done with that, we hope you'll help us, right? And that went a long way. And at the end, the FBI LEGAT comes into my office. She's like, how the hell did you get this guy out of the country in 6 months? I can't get this drug dealer out. It was great. It was a great case all around. I loved that one too.
Yeah, I think it's probably the quickest extradition I've ever heard of. Extraditing people can be really difficult, if not impossible, depending on what country you're dealing with and all of the political factors. But I think it was under a year from when he was caught in South Africa to when he got off a plane here in LA with courtesy of the marshals, which is kind of unheard of.
It was crazy. And the real craziest part of that case, and we'll end on this part, is that I was in South Africa when he got arrested there, and my 5-year tour ended right around the time he was extradited back. So the day he arrived in Los Angeles, he arrived like about 11 o'clock at night in LA at LAX. I was waiting for him. I actually picked him up, took him to jail on that night when he came in. His head must have been spinning.
Oh, I doubt he was happy to see you. Yeah.
I mean, I think that has tremendous deterrence, because he must think, holy smokes, these guys on a plant case. Yeah. I couldn't get anything past them. That's good stuff. I like that case too, Matt. That was a good one. But you've done a lot of cool cases, and we were just talking before we started this recording. You've got one going on right now that I guarantee you, you're going to be back here for another episode. So you're already booked.
it's a deal. It's an ongoing case, so I can't really talk about it. But it's involves a kind of a colorful cast of wildlife smugglers.
It's a good one. When we can tell that one, I think my audience will be like, holy shit. And this is, we can curse on this podcast if you want to. Dennis, tell us about some of your great memories. How long have you been with the U.S. Attorney's Office?
23 years.
And how long in the environmental crimes?
I think since 2008.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah.
So a lot of experience. You have a depth of knowledge, and you've done a lot of cases. You and I did a couple of trials together. We went to trial.
We had a great, the one I was going to discuss was the Jerry Snapp case.
Oh, Jerry Snapp.
Which I thought was, you know, because it wasn't a major type case. Mm. It dealt with a, you know, violation of the Endangered Species Act. But there's some interesting things we learned from it, which I think the audience should know. For instance, and by the way, at the very beginning, you were mentioning how there isn't much dispute about protecting wildlife and so forth. I just learned the other day that the Endangered Species Act, which was sort of like one of the first things to protect the environment, federal acts, I think it was inspired or supported by President Nixon.
Yeah.
In the late 60s.
That's right.
So our friend Jerry Snapp, this was kind of a funny factual scenario as well. And of course, this case went to trial and you and I did the trial and we had it was a fun trial. There was an elephant, an Asian elephant at the LA Zoo. Her name was Annie. Mm. And she passed away. What she passed away from, I'm not sure.
It was Shigella, of all things.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. I can't even really describe what Shigella is. But it causes a lot of diarrhea and dehydration. So that's what kills you.
And she ended up, you know, the carcass, I guess they couldn't, from what I understood, was the carcass could not be incinerated at the zoo. So it was sent, the carcass was sent to a rendering plant. What's a rendering plant? Mm. But I learned that that's where, you know, animals are processed into product, like, you know, into soap, for example, and then sold. So the carcass was sent to this rendering plant, and one of the guys working there, I guess the leg and the head of the elephant, of Annie, was offered by one of the employees there to Jerry Snapp. And this was kind of he was a very colorful personality.
He was.
Older guy, and he spent probably a very good chunk of his life collecting all sorts of animal artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to, I don't know if he paid for it, but he somehow got his hands on this head of an elephant, and I think maybe the leg as well. Not sure about the leg, but he definitely got the head.
Right.
And he took this thing to his home, and he wanted to get, what he did was he put beetles on the head. This is a little gruesome, but the beetles over the course of many months or years eat away at the flesh, and in the end, he had a perfectly preserved elephant skull. And it's kind of a rare thing to have. And I think, and eventually he fell on harder times, I guess, and he wanted to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And he made an offer. He put it out on Craigslist. And he announced, you know, that he was offering to sell this thing for, I think he was trying to get $9,000 for it. Now, the Endangered Species Act prohibits you not just from trafficking in live animals, but it also, and this is the important thing, is it prohibits you from trafficking in dead animals or any part of an animal. Dead or alive, it all counts because you don't want people trafficking in these things that are protected. Otherwise, if someone knows that a particular part of an endangered species is valuable, then there's going to be, you know, a race to capture these things, kill them, and sell the parts. So here he is offering this elephant skull on Craigslist. Craigslist is a nationwide service. Therefore, it's in interstate commerce. And I believe some agents in the state of Washington picked up on this
right. And
saw that he was offering it. And then, Ed, you got involved and became and acted undercover and did a fantastic job and, you know, said you were interested in buying it. And I think he was making you a deal. I think he wanted to sell it for about $9,000, but he was willing to let it go for $4,500.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a research institute that wanted to buy it, but they wanted, paperwork. And Jerry, of course, couldn't provide paperwork because you couldn't have it. It was the Asian elephant is on the endangered species list.
Right.
And you cannot traffic in that in interstate commerce or any part of it. And you can't offer to do it.
Right.
And so you negotiated with him on the phone. And then, you know, I think one of the best things you did in the case, because when we have federal misdemeanors, those are typically strict liability. You could have the best intention in the world, but if you're knowing what you're doing and what you're doing is in violation of a federal law, such as the Endangered Species Act, and there are other federal statutes that impose strict criminal liability, because what's being protected is so important that you better know what you're doing before you engage in it. But you went further than that. You were going to transport the skull. You said, well, I'm going to take this up to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do if I get pulled over? And he was giving you advice like, well, you wouldn't be as much trouble if you had like the whale skull that I have here at my house. But just, you know, throw a tarp over it. Don't tell him you're driving with anything that you're going to sell. Rather, just tell them, you know, that you're moving up there and you're just dropping off some stuff and so forth. So he was giving advice because he knew you can't transport that.
Right.
And that was our interstate commerce connection. He was offering an endangered species for sale in interstate commerce. We had a lot of evidence on Mr. Snap. For some reason, he chose to go to trial.
Yeah.
And, you know, most cases we do, I think Mark and Matt would agree with me that over 90% of what we charge, if not 95%, ends up pleading out. Very few cases. And that's probably true with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Most cases plead.
Because the cases are well done when you get, I mean.
Yeah, you want them well done. Yeah. You want to have a lot of evidence. And they'll get a lighter sentence if they accept responsibility and plead guilty.
Right.
Jerry Snap decided not to do it. And he went to trial. And the trial went smoothly. And everything went fine. The most unusual thing, I guess, about the trial was, you know, exhibit one, I'm not sure what exhibit number it was, but one of the exhibits was the elephant skull.
The skull itself.
And yeah. The judge was rather, you know, sensitive about the idea of this thing being in the courtroom, particularly overnight. So he would require, this elephant skull was the size of, you know, these chairs.
Yeah, I mean,
it was
huge.
Huge, and it was heavy.
Had hundreds of pounds.
And Ed, I remember you got, you know, stuck with the task of taking this thing out of the courtroom, you know, during the break, you know, for the next day.
Yeah.
And that thing was huge.
Yeah.
And so he ended up getting convicted. But even before, you know, before trial and so forth, when you were negotiating with him, you went to visit him at his home.
Yeah.
And he had lots of different things that, you know, from different animals and so forth. He was really, you know, an enthusiast. Unfortunately, he was breaking the law along with it, which was a shame. He ended up getting convicted. You know, the Endangered Species Act is a misdemeanor statute. When you violate it, it's only misdemeanor penalties. Now, we do have in our arsenal other federal wildlife statutes that are felonies. The Lacey Act got mentioned. That you can charge misdemeanor or felony depending on the facts. Smuggling, which often takes place with wildlife trafficking, those are felony offenses. But the Endangered Species Act, all of those offenses are a misdemeanor. He got convicted, and I think he was ultimately sentenced to a term of home detention.
Yeah.
And then I remember, like, a year or two later, I think the LA Times did quite a profile on him.
They did, yeah.
Yeah.
And they were very sympathetic to him, actually.
Yeah.
But you know what's interesting about that case, Dennis? I don't know if you remember this, but we did him a solid, a big solid, because he offered to sell that thing in interstate commerce. And you're right, it was a Washington agent who picked up on it. And that agent actually got a tip about it from somebody who was thinking about buying it and then realized, oh, that's probably illegal.
Yeah.
And me and that agent in Washington kind of cooked up this undercover. Let's go. Because honestly, I didn't believe he was going to have an elephant skull. When have we ever encountered that, right?
Yeah.
The guy's got an Asian elephant skull for sale. We've never seen that.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a scam. But I thought, okay, we'll go meet with him. But while we were meeting with him, we talked about, we're going to take this up to Washington. And he actually offered to drive it up there for us. Now, if he had done that, that would have been a felony Lacey Act violation, right?
Yeah.
So we actually were like, no, no, that's okay. Because looking at him, you know, like you said, he was a pretty eccentric guy. He had the one elephant skull for sale. He was interested in selling a rhino skull.
Right.
But other than that, it didn't look like he was systemically involved in wildlife trafficking. But couldn't let him do this crime. But we actually did him a solid. We could have hooked him up for a felony there, you know, if we'd let him drive it to Washington State. And he would have been looking at a felony record and a lot more time in jail. And here, you know, that's okay. I'd never had any hard feelings about him going to trial, but it's just ironic that he was so affronted that we gave him a misdemeanor charge.
I was surprised he went. It really, because we were up against a very good defense lawyer from the Public Defender's Office, Anthony Eaglin, really terrific trial lawyer. But, you know, there's only so much a lawyer can do when the facts are, you know, so heavily against you.
Do you remember what Jerry wore to his trial? Do you remember?
I don't.
He wore kind of a flowery shirt.
Oh, really?
Unbuttoned almost down to his navel. And he was really tan. He was really tan, blonde hair, stringy, shoulder length hair.
Wow. Yeah.
And he sat the whole trial right in front of the jury with his shirt unbuttoned down to his
belly. Yeah, it was a jury trial.
Did he testify at trial?
Did he? I can't remember if he testified.
I don't think he did.
No. That was an odd case. And so often trials for me, I think the two or three of the trials I had in my career were misdemeanor trials. People wanted trials for misdemeanor charges. Let me ask you this, though. So I know listeners sometimes think, I have a strong opinion about this, why we did it. But, you know, you mentioned this is a misdemeanor case. It's not a wild elephant. We found out from our investigation that the elephant lived at the LA Zoo, right? So why is this important from an endangered species perspective or a law enforcement or a deterrence perspective?
Well, if you don't enforce these prohibitions against designed to protect an endangered species or a species that's protected by the International Convention for the Protection of Wildlife, which is called, nicknamed CITES, you're allowing a market to exist.
Exactly.
And you're going to have poaching. You're going to have wholesale slaughters in places of these, you know, protected animals.
Right.
And you can't have that.
Right.
And so it was an important case because here you had a part of a dead animal. Yeah, it was not roaming in the wild. It was in a zoo. But an elephant skull is an elephant skull, and an Asian elephant skull is one of those two main species, and that one's protected, and you can't allow that. So we had to do something.
Yeah, and I guarantee you there's somebody out there who saw that ad on Craigslist and said, you know what? I want an elephant skull.
Yeah.
Or some other kind of weird skull, right?
Right.
So you're right. It develops, it drives a market. And that's one of the things that our collective mission is to kill the market as much as we can.
Yeah. No, we've had separate cases where what was at stake were parts of animals.
Yeah.
We've had, you know, rhino horns. We've had, there was a store in West Hollywood that specialized in selling dried out, you know, animals. Some of, you know, what was being sold there was protected. And we went after that store and the owner.
Okay.
You know, and those were, nothing was live. These were just dead animals. But
yeah, I mean, it's interesting because a lot of,
too.
It's not always about protecting the animals. It's a lot of profiteering on the backs of the animals.
Exactly.
Because we have these laws that protect the animals in the wild, but where we come in, it's where people are taking animals or animal parts and making money off of them.
Right.
They're committing fraud. I mean, I think everybody understands what fraud is. You're selling something, you know, in a shady way, you're trafficking something illegally, and then you're putting money in your pocket. And that's really what it's about.
Right. It's a greed thing versus an animal loving thing, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you're getting animals killed for their part.
Right.
Like a rhino horn, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. I always try to say to people, you know, our job really isn't about saving an individual animal. It's about saving a species, right? Right. Keeping that pressure off. So, okay. So Matt gets a check for talking about a case I did with him. Dennis, check, did a case I did with you.
Pressure's on. Okay. The pressure's on.
No.
All right.
You better come up with one I didn't do with you, Mark.
I've got one. I've done a lot of wildlife cases over the years. I mean, I think I've done poached leopard sharks.
Yeah.
I've done bear bile where people are smuggling bear gallbladders for bile. I've done butterflies. I've done Asian songbirds in people's pants on international flights.
Right.
I've done tarantulas. I've helped with rhino horns. I mean, it's kind of run the gamut. And you've been a big part of a huge chunk of that stuff. And I think, were you involved in the leopard shark case that Dorothy Kim charged way back?
I don't know. Peripherally, okay. Probably.
Probably.
But not maybe not as the case agent.
Yeah, but I know we've worked together on a lot of things over the years. You know, butterfly guy comes to mind. but I think the one I want to talk about is the tarantula smuggler.
Yes,
that was interesting.
Good.
So
I like that one too.
There was a great agent out here. His name was Paul Montori.
Yep.
Just recently retired. Really?
Did he?
Really?
I didn't
good
even
guy.
Know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he's working for the state in Washington now. Is
good
it?
For him.
And he identified what we believed at the time, I think correctly, was the world's largest tarantula exporter. This guy was selling protected tarantulas like Mexican red-kneed tarantulas and other things throughout the world. He was all over the internet. He was sending packages with literally thousands of tarantulas everywhere to Mexico, United States, all over Europe. And Paul called me one day. He's like, Mark, I got this lead. You know, what do you think? And I said, sounds great, Paul, but where's this guy located? And he's like, well, let's figure it out. So Paul unfortunately nicknamed the case Operation Spider-Man. not the most original operation name, but there you go. And we figured out the guy was in Germany, of all places.
Yep.
And so one of the biggest issues in the case was, well, if we charge him in the United States and he's in Germany, we're going to have this extradition process and it makes the prosecution a lot more difficult. So we had some different options and we talked, you know, when we started the podcast, we talked a lot about partnerships.
Yeah.
We worked with DOJ's Office of International Affairs to reach out to Germany to say, hey, we've got this target in your country. Would you be interested in helping us, you know, work this target? You know, the United States just can't go to foreign countries and deploy law enforcement and do things.
That's what the movies tell us.
Yeah, that is what the movies tell us. But unfortunately, we're not Navy SEALs. We don't do black ops wildlife things yet. Just kidding. But so we worked with the German authorities and they said, yeah, we're definitely interested. He's a high volume guy. We'll help you do what we call a ruse, where we work an undercover into Germany. Nice. So, you know, we posed online as a buyer and did some confidence buys. We called them with the target. He sent the tranches over here. They were all protected. Of course, he said really bad stuff on his import paperwork, like they're kids' toys or whatever, when really they're tarantulas. And the way these things are packaged are really interesting. They're in these plastic tubes, and the tarantulas kind of, they're live, and they're kind of thin plastic tubes, almost like a pencil case. And there's hundreds of these in the box. And if they mark them as kids' toys, you know, customs is going to shake the package and you don't know it's a tarantula, but there are thousands of these things in there.
Yikes.
So we did a few buys, you know, and he kept selling. So we thought we got to take this guy down. So we developed a plan where we're going to open a pet shop out here, at least what we told him. And we wanted him to be our keynote speaker, the marquee guy at the grand opening of our pet shop. And he said, well, do I get to come to the United States? We're like, absolutely. You can come to the United States if you really want to. He's like, yeah, I want to come. And we're like, okay, how about we buy your ticket? He's like, that's great. We'll do it. And so, you know, we bought the ticket. He flew over, picked him up at the airport. You know, great, good to meet you. And you know, the agents are all undercover. They've got the car wired up. You know, so they've got cameras in the car. They're all mic'd up, recording everything. You know, they're chit-chatting on the way to the grand opening of the pet shop. Like, yeah, you know, some of these tarantulas are illegal. We better not tell anybody. It's like, yeah, that's, you know, we shouldn't tell anybody about this. We'd get in big trouble.
Beautiful.
And he actually, I think, brought tarantulas with him, too, on the flight. So get to the pet shop, and it's a room kind of like this. It's a warehouse, basically, that was rented out and had cameras and everything. He made some more great admissions about not wanting to get in trouble. And then, of course, they brought out the handcuffs and arrested him. We charged him here with felonies. And, you know, when you're charged with federal felonies, you have a decision to make. You can either go to trial like Jerry Snapp, which you have a complete right to, and we respect that. And, you know, it's your constitutional right to fight the charges if you think it's appropriate.
Sure.
Or you can plead guilty or you can cooperate. And, you know, he decided, I think, to have the benefit of pleading guilty. Still went to federal prison for 6 months, though.
Nice.
The way federal, you know this, but for your audience, the way the federal sentencing guidelines work are the more money you deal in illegally, the higher your sentence exposure. So you have a guidelines number that you get, and it could be from 0 to 50, basically. And if you're dealing in the low thousands, you could be like 0 to 10. If you're dealing in the mid hundreds of thousands, you're, you know, maybe 10 to 20. And when you get into the millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions, that level of fraud, your prison exposure goes way up.
Right.
And because he was a massive tarantula smuggler, his exposure is pretty high. But, you know, because he did some work for us and, you know, helped himself out, he got 6 months in prison, and it was an interesting case.
I remember, yeah, so that, I remember that, that Paul was working on that, and boy, that was a creepy one.
It was.
Oh, the spiders, you know, they're either holding still or they're moving real fast.
I'm not a big tarantula guy, but yeah, there's, there were definitely creepy crawly spiders. Yeah.
So was Germany happy with the result on that, or did they do anything, or what do you know about what happened over there?
So we briefed them up through our Office of International Affairs, and they were extremely enthusiastic. You know, they were happy to be part of the whole thing. You know, I think law enforcement there doesn't do a lot of wildlife crimes out of Germany, and they thought it was a unique case, but given the fraud and the smuggling aspect of it, which is really a border security issue, they didn't want this guy setting contraband, you know, throughout Europe, and, you know, they're happy he got some prison time. So yeah, it's a great case.
Very cool. Yeah. You know, I'm glad you brought up the sentencing guidelines, because I think sometimes people get confused, you know, because in the media, a lot of times when these people are arrested, it'll say, facing up to, you know, 5 years in prison on a Lacey Act case, and a $250,000 fine maximum, or a smuggling case, they'll say facing up to 20 years in prison, right? And then when the case is over and the next media report says, well, they got 6 months in jail or a year in jail. You mentioned, you did a great job describing how the sentencing guidelines work, but I want to dive in a little deeper on that, because you mentioned numbers. And So those numbers don't necessarily reflect years in prison, right? Explain how those numbers, well, you're basically looking at a book that helps you come up with a number, right?
You have this book, it's called the Sentencing Guidelines, and in the back of the book, you have a chart.
Right.
And so on the top of the chart, it's got your criminal history. So you're a zero if you've never done anything, and you could be up to a category six, I think, or five if you have a lot of priors.
Okay, so you could start, you're going to start with a number. It's either going to be zero or some other number if you have a prior criminal history.
So let's say you've committed maybe a couple felonies, you're probably criminal history two or three.
Okay.
So you move to that position on the top of the chart. And down on the left side of the chart, there's another number, zero to, I think it's 50 43. Or 40, something 43. Like that. Yeah. So to, if you commit a murder, you know, first degree murder, premeditated stuff with a number of victims, you're going to be right at the bottom of 43.
Got it.
If you committed, you know, maybe theft of mail or something like that, or misdemeanor, you're going to be, you know, zero to six somewhere in there.
Okay.
And then you have kind of characteristics that are applied to. So let's say there's a huge number of victims. So for example, we prosecuted a case and took it to trial a couple years ago involving a dive boat that caught on fire, and 34 people were killed in that fire. Everybody on board, essentially, all the passengers. That's an enhancement. 34 victims is a big enhancement. Let's say you have vulnerable victims like children or the elderly. That's another enhancement. So there's all these different enhancements that can apply. If you used a gun, if you're a felon in possession, those types of things. So those can bump your number up. So you'll go down the left side of the column and find, you know, whatever your total number is for the seriousness of that offense. And then you go to the middle point, and you take your top and your left, you go to the middle, and there's a prison range associated with that particular thing.
Got it.
Could be, and it's always in months. So it could be 0 to 6 months, it could be 150 to 180 months, whatever the case may be. And the judge uses that as kind of a guideline, a starting point for their analysis of the prison sentence the judge should apply. Now, as you know, federal judges do whatever federal judges want to do. They're presidentially appointed for life. They have the benefit of that. They look at the guidelines and they may take it real seriously, or they may think it overestimates the offense. They may think it underestimates the offense, and they'll apply whatever prison sentence they can up to the statutory maximum, which is what you said before.
Right.
So whenever we charge a case, there's a maximum sentence. Could be 5 years or 20 years. It could be life. I've only had a few cases where a judge maxed out a defendant.
Yeah.
Usually you're not anywhere close to that statutory maximum sentence, but you always want to make sure the defendant knows, hey, this is my total exposure here. If I go to trial, I could go to prison for 20 years.
Right.
Maybe very unlikely, but you want to make sure they're on notice that, yeah, this could happen. So.
And that's a good point, because defendants are always told, U.S. government does not keep secrets from people that they're prosecuting, right? And they're always told exactly where they come out on the sentencing guidelines or where the government believes they come out, right? So they kind of know, okay, the government thinks I'm at a seven or whatever, so that's going to expose me to this possible sentence, right?
Exactly, yep.
And that's the key thing. The guidelines are just that, they're guidelines. So federal judges don't have to follow them. They can upward depart or downward depart. But generally, they all want to sentence similarly so that, you know, if you're in New York, you don't get a harsher sentence for the same crime that somebody else did in Los Angeles. You want to keep it relatively the same for similarly situated defendants. So you've mentioned some things where you can, like, certain behaviors that a defendant can engage in can add points to their where they come out on the sentencing guidelines. But it's also possible for a defendant to reduce their numbers, right?
Right.
What sort of things can a defendant do to reduce the numbers?
Well, the biggest thing is to cooperate. I think right off the bat, telling the truth and cooperating with law enforcement gets you a big benefit. If you accept responsibility, that's a 3-point reduction.
Right.
If you cooperate, the government can make a motion that says this defendant assisted us by providing information about other targets, by being truthful about what they did. Could be a situation where the defendant, him or herself, goes undercover and does transactions. Right. We've certainly had a number of wildlife cases where we've had cooperating targets and cooperating defendants. And that will immediately reduce the prison exposure. And then the government keeps all that information sealed until we need to produce it for a trial. But then the person gets a benefit at sentencing after they plead guilty, because the guidelines are reduced, which means the prison exposure is reduced too. So that's probably the biggest way.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think that helps people understand how you, you know, can be charged with a crime that has this horrendously frightening max.
Right.
And then you can get it down to a lower level. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you guys feel that does that decrease the deterrent impact of prosecuting these crimes to have, you know, somebody who's charged and they're, you know, looking at 5 years max, but then they only get 6 months. Does that increase the deterrent value just based on your experience, what you've seen?
You know, with the guidelines, it's really, it's trying to not custom make it, but have that defendant get what should be a just sentence.
Right.
And that means taking into account the criminal history, the offense level, and the offense level, as Mark pointed out, is based on how much money was involved, what kind of characteristics were also involved, like, vulnerable victim was involved, it's going to increase the offense level. Where sophisticated means used, that's going to increase it.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, you mentioned this a second ago about decreasing it. And one of course, would be cooperation. Another one is somebody could be involved in a conspiracy to do something, but was really sort of a minor participant or a minimal participant.
Right.
And there are occasions where we'll see that as well. And we'll say, well, you know what, let's decrease the offense level a little bit to compensate for that, because this person really wasn't the leader. On the other hand, if somebody was a leader, we call that an aggravated role, mm-hmm. and it goes up. So these characteristics that are going to drive somebody in being able to consult with their lawyer to figure out where do they stand in the guidelines. We usually won't advise them of that. It's more the defense lawyer is going to tell his client, look, I think this is where you're going, but there's no guarantees. And when defendants plead guilty, the judges make a point of saying, look, the sentence is up to me. I'll listen to what your lawyer has to say. I'll listen to what the government has to say. I'm going to consult the guidelines, and then then I'll decide.
I mean, not to get too technical, but I think anytime you're sending somebody to prison for wildlife crimes, that's a deterrent.
Yeah.
I mean, people think that they're going to sell an elephant skull and everything's going to work out fine and they're going to pocket 10 grand or something, but anytime they're going to prison for things like that, I think that's very important for deterrence.
Aaron Dean and I used to have a saying that, you know, if we caught somebody blatantly smuggling, they were getting arrested because just that one night that they spend means a lot.
Give a sample.
That first night they spend in jail means a lot. And in terms of deterrent, have you guys seen a lot of repeat offenders? I think that's a telltale sign of whether deterrence is working or not. Do you see a lot of repeaters?
That's a good question. I mean, we were talking about the Byung-Soo Kim earlier, the classic example of a repeat offender. He gets caught here, flees the country, and then just goes to South Africa and does the same thing. I mean, that's kind of an extreme example. I think, at least in my experience, defendants don't necessarily get caught doing the same thing, you know, a few years later. It's more that they were caught in their past for committing other crimes. They served some sort of prison or jail sentence, and then we catch them again doing something a little different, something that they, you know, a wildlife crime that maybe they hadn't gotten caught doing in the past, and now they get caught. Mm. So it's the recidivism, which is something federal judges take very seriously. It's always an issue, but some people just can't help themselves. I've had cases, not in the wildlife context, where someone gets caught doing one thing, maybe it killed somebody, and then they go to prison, then they get out and they just keep at it. I mean, it's just kind of human nature, unfortunately. In that situation, the federal judges will tend to hammer the defendant at sentencing the second time around.
Yeah.
And that multiple offenses raises your number on that sentencing guidelines. And, you know, I always felt like the warning for people is that first time, the first offender in a federal system is likely going to get cut some breaks, but don't show up again, because that's when judges will really turn on you, right?
Right. And one thing that federal judges, I mean, a lot of work goes into the sentencing process. Mm. The probation office before sentencing prepares a detailed report for the judge about both the crime, but just as important, the defendant's background. And, you know, did they have a rough childhood, their kind of personal history? And a lot of times the defendant has a kind of sympathetic things, reasons in their past why a judge might give them a break the first time around. The second time around, that, you know, that's out the window, and they tend to receive very heavy sentences.
Yeah. Interesting.
Very true.
What about like proof issues? Do you think in wildlife crimes or wildlife prosecutions, do you guys have unique proof problems or proof issues that you might not have in other types of criminal activity?
I think one of the challenges for judges is how to line up a wildlife crime sentence with other types of crimes. You know, it's not really a drug offense. There's usually no guns. It's a very unique type of offense. And I think the way that we normally approach that is to tell them it's fraud. You know, this is fraud like anything else. It's lying on paperwork. It's, you know, the government has a responsibility to make sure packages and the ports are safe. If we don't know what's in containers, can't do that job. And the other piece is it's about the money. You know, it's always about profit and money. So I think those, convincing a judge that these types of cases are important is a challenge for us sometimes. Right. Oftentimes with the jury, they know, they get it right off the bat. You know, there's, you know, we've had a number of trials involving birds and other things that are smuggled. A jury gets it. You know, somebody put a live animal in a package and called it a kid's toy or plumbing equipment. And, I mean, they understand that, right? They wanted this person is making money by selling live animals. You know, they knew what they were doing was wrong because we'll always have emails or text messages where the person's saying, I'm going to falsely declare this stuff, basically. So, you know, we know they have the intent, and a jury, I think, gets it right away. So when we go to trial on wildlife crimes, we, I would say, almost 100% of the time get convictions. Yeah. I'm having a hard time coming up with a wildlife crime trial where we had an acquittal.
Yeah, I don't remember one during my career at all.
Yeah, and I've been doing this for 17 years now, and I don't remember one either.
Yeah.
So a jury, I think, gets it, but then when it comes time for sentencing, a judge is a different kind of person to convince, which is different challenges for us.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things Mark was mentioning for proof for trials, when you're dealing with felonies, you got to show some kind of bad faith, some sort of mental, you know, intent to violate the law. Like the smuggling statute, for instance, requires that. So we're not always going to have a confession, but there's other ways of, you know, that we can show that so-and-so knew that they were violating the law, and they false declarations, the way they lied about paperwork,
right?
Or the way that things are, we catch smugglers in the way they package, you know. You were involved on a coral investigation, which was a major investigation that we did. And in that case, the defendant companies, they were importing protected corals along with importing corals that were legal. The legal ones would be at the top of these plastic bags with, you know, in the salt water. Then there'd be some newspaper. And below that, you had the protected corals that were being hidden, you know. Or we've seen suitcases for like Asian songbirds or whatever, where they're in the suitcase, suddenly there's a layer, there's clothing at the top, then there's a layer, you know, of a foil or something like that. And then below that, we've got, you know, the contraband, you know, the smuggled animals.
Yeah, the method itself is kind of a...
The method tells you they know that they're breaking the law.
Yeah.
Why go through that trouble?
Yeah, exactly. And we're not prosecuting record-keeping offenses. Where they're importing a wame and they call it a shama thrush, to use the Asian songbird thing.
Right.
These aren't technical offenses. They're smuggling, calling it something completely different.
Right.
We had a case involving cobras that were smuggled in Pringles jars.
Yeah.
Live cobras in Pringles jars. I mean, can you imagine if a wildlife inspector who didn't know there was a cobra in there opened up what he thought was a food container and he got bit by a baby cobra?
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been lethal.
It could have been, yeah.
Sometimes it could be pretty serious.
And you know what should also be pointed out is very often these animals don't, or a good number of the animals don't survive,
right,
you know, the smuggling.
Yeah.
We had one guy who was trying to smuggle tortoises out of the country. He used a fake name. And just his luck, the fake name he used was a name that was, you know, caused this thing to be inspected. But at first it was just so it wasn't allowed to go out. And the package was just put into the dead male category or whatever. It was just sitting there. And after a while, someone smelled something funny from the package. It opened up and one of the tortoises already, you know, rotted away. Or, you know, with birds coming in, not all of them survive it. Because you know, these are being put in the luggage compartment of an airliner that's, you know, it's freezing temperatures up there. I mean, you know, it's no surprise that a lot of them will die in the process.
Yeah, we used to say, you know, smugglers, if they needed to bring in 100 birds, reptiles, whatever it was, they actually needed to bring in 200 because they could count on about a 50% mortality rate because of the way they have to hide things. It's very cruel to the animal, right? keeping it from making noise. So they'll often tape its mouth shut or tape something in its mouth so that restricts breathing. Yeah, it's not a pretty thing. I think, you know, for me as an investigator, one of the biggest proof issues I always had to tackle was, you know, your victims and your witnesses can't give you a statement, right? Our victims cannot come testify in court.
Right.
They can't give a statement about what happened to them. And so, you know, that's a challenge in terms of developing evidence against people for sure. How about this? You know, we discussed this. You've been really lucky to have this dedicated environmental crimes unit. What are the benefits of having that unit? Like, what do you see as the benefits for counter wildlife trafficking, protection of wildlife, enforcement of wildlife laws? How does having a dedicated unit at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Central District really benefit that or help that?
I mean, in a bunch of ways. I think one of the most important ways is these are complicated statutes that we're dealing with. Often the judges in our cases have never dealt with the statutes that we're charging. And some of the statutes are very complicated, like the Lacey Act.
Mm-hmm.
And so it helps to have prosecutors who have charged these cases repeatedly and who have some, you know, kind of institutional knowledge about which statutes apply and the pluses and minuses of charging a kind of maybe an obscure statute that, I mean, sometimes the statutes have never been charged before. There's there's no background law on them. And so because we've all been in the section for, I mean, I'm the newest prosecutor, and I've been in the section for about 9 years.
Yeah.
But you really develop some expertise, which wouldn't be the case if you were a prosecutor who said, for example, was doing mostly, you know, drug or gang or gun cases and just got handed a wildlife case. So
right.
I think that's one of the biggest benefits, in my opinion.
And Matt, I think the other thing is when new prosecutors come to the section, there's a steep learning curve. There's
right.
the Lacey Act, Endangered Species Act, CITES, all these things. And the interesting thing is the bad guys know these rules like the back of their hand.
That's right.
They know the Code of Federal Regulations and the weights and the types of species. They've got all this stuff dialed, and they've been working around it mm-hmm. for years. A new lawyer comes to the section, and they're like, what is this? You know, right. we're giving them books on regulations and training and stuff, and it takes time to ramp up. And I think when you have institutional knowledge like these two guys in the section who've been there for a decade and well over a decade, you know, that kind of a specialization is important because we can work cases efficiently. We're not having to build a plane while we're flying it. We've already built the plane and we just take off and go. So, you know, we want to keep pace with the criminals who are way ahead on the regulations. And I think specialization is crucial to that for us.
Yeah, you know, from the investigator side, I have to agree, because if you're working in a district that does not have an environmental crimes unit, prosecutors who haven't done it, it's the agent's job to kind of educate the prosecutor about Lacey Act or all the statutes. And, you know, we cannot get into this now because we'll be here for another hour and a half.
Yeah.
But the Lacey Act really gets complicated when you get into start talking about the triggering event, right? And I just saw Mark, he just put his head down and shook his head because
I avoid the Lacey Act like my entire career. It's like a last, yeah.
How many conversations have we had, agent to, prosecutor, where's the triggering event, right? Oh my gosh. And a lot of times in order for the Lacey Act to apply, some event has to occur. And that's what we call the triggering event. And often there's disagreement between agent and prosecutor about whether the triggering event happened or what it was. And sometimes there's disagreement between two prosecutors about what it is. It takes time to dial in on that. And so, having a dedicated unit, people with institutional memory and experience is super important.
Yeah, so, and the bad guys know that the Lacey Act is complicated.
Yes.
And if they, drive something to a certain place and send it out of a certain facility, they can kind of get around certain rules and things like that. So yeah, they're ahead on that.
Right, right. What about just kind of thinking overall during your careers, what kind of contributions do you feel the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Central District has made to protecting wildlife and plants native to this country, as well as wildlife and plants around the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think across administrations, we have different priorities with different U.S. attorneys. Our current U.S. attorney has been very supportive of dogfighting cases, international cases involving, you know, targets bringing in fighting dogs to the district and selling them. And, you know, fighting dogs can be tens of thousands of dollars, and it's a very gruesome sport. You know, we've had other U.S. attorneys focused on different aspects like international trafficking of large things like elephant tusks and rhino horns. We've done big rhino horn prosecutions under those administrations. So I think every U.S. attorney has different priorities, and our job as prosecutors is to make sure that we're putting our resources into whatever that U.S. attorney wants to prioritize.
Right.
You know, there's not 50 of us in the section. We have to specialize and we have to prioritize, and we want to do cases where there's, you know, repeat offenders, a lot of intent. You know, we're not prosecuting borderline cases here. We're prosecuting cases where the target we know is guilty because they have the criminal intent to do the thing that we're accusing them of doing. They've done it many, many times. You know, high dollar value, we're taking folks off the street that are at the pinnacle of their game, whether it's rhino horns or butterflies or Asian songbirds. Those are the impact cases we want to do in this district. And I think it's just a matter of aligning our resources with the U.S. attorney's priorities and kind of getting the job done.
Yeah, you know, I think it's critically important for investigators and agents to understand what the current U.S. attorney's priorities are, too. Because the number one question, I think, see if you guys agree with this, the number one question an agent can answer when they come into your office is, here's my case, here's why it's important, right? Because you're going to ask, why is this important? Why do I care today about butterflies?
Right.
Why do I care about seabirds, right? The agent needs to be able to articulate to you guys, how does this mesh with the U.S. attorney's priorities for this district, right?
Yeah, 100%. And it could be, you know, for example, I didn't know, but in the Asian songbird community, you can have really high value songbirds that are traded for counterfeit currency, which is then traded for narcotics. And the narcotics are then traded for firearms.
And that may be a high priority for your particular
U.S. attorney. And you have this circle of contraband that's exchanged depending, you know, you could trade a wildlife part for a gun.
Right.
And we have a lot of wildlife traffickers that have firearms. So transnational crime is a big problem that we're trying to focus on. And wildlife smuggling is central to that because it is a piece that is used in that by criminals to exchange for other things to accomplish their crimes.
You know what I think is a great example of that is zoonotic disease.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because you mentioned songbirds, and you know, in my mind, the thing my friends always tease me about it because I'm scared to death that bird flu is going to get into this country in a form. That is easily transmitted to humans at a 30% mortality rate.
Right.
And if it happens, it's going to come from wild birds. And wild bird smuggling is a potential corridor for that.
Yeah, 100%.
So, I'll tell you what else is interesting. I remember years ago I had a lizard smuggling case where lizards were being brought in, I believe, from Australia. Well, because it came in from overseas and we caught the guy and he pled and so forth, but the lizards couldn't be returned back to the natural habitat.
Right.
They had to be kept in a special place, you know, because they may have some kind of virus or something in their, you know, biology that could be extremely harmful to the native lizards here. So they could not go back.
There's a whole other topic for a podcast too, right? About repatriation of live animals and how difficult that is, right?
Yeah. And there's an international trade component too. So timber cases, for example, you can have protected wood species that other countries are kind of, they're called anti-dumping cases where they're taking this hardwood and selling it very cheaply in the United States and out competing local folks for the same wood.
Right.
And those are the types of cases that's essentially a fraud case, but it impacts international trade because you're dealing with massive quantities of this wood that's being sold at pennies and then it's used for furniture or guitars, for example, or whatever the case may be. So there's a big kind of international trade aspect to it that we could go into a long, long time.
If we start adding timber and plants into our calculation,
it gets big.
Dennis, I think you and I did a rosewood case involving guitars.
Mark was in on that one, too.
Yeah, I think you were in on that,
rosewood.
Too.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking about, right?
We had to do
trying to export it overseas.
We did a controlled delivery search warrant or something like that.
Yeah.
So I could talk to you guys all day, in part because I know you so well and it's so natural just to, you know, talk shop with you guys. I love it. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show. We're running out of time. Before we sign off, though, I'll just give you go one at a time, you know, your closing thoughts, anything you want the public to know about what you do or the cases you've handled or anything.
I'll just, one thing we haven't talked about is just all of the work we do that's not exactly wildlife focused, but it's more environmental, like oil spills, forest fires, that sort of thing. We do a lot of those cases, and in those cases, there's a lot of human victims, but there's also wildlife victims as well. So that's another important subject matter that we focus on a lot. And I think the public understands that, you know, we're enforcing criminal laws against wrongdoers, corporate wrongdoers, individual wrongdoers in Southern California for kind of disaster type events that also, you know, have a terrible impact on the environment. So it's another very rewarding element of what we do.
That's a great point. Yeah, there's a public safety, public health issues get tangled up in this as well, right? Great. Dennis?
Yeah, just to expound a little bit on what Matt was saying. We're a relatively small section, but our variety of cases and investigations is by far the largest. Mm. We do everything from unsafe drugs, unsafe air travel, oil spills, forest fires, hazardous waste, hazardous materials, water pollution, you name it. Some of these are extremely complicated statutes, especially because of the regulations.
Right.
So it's so important for us to maintain our section and to have the institutional knowledge because, you know, I remember the first hazardous waste case that I did. Mm. I was thinking, oh, waste is just, you know, something you're just throwing away. And I remember Mark was about to go to trial. I think I got this case about 30 days or something before the trial date. Mm. And Mark says, look, Dennis, you better start taking a look at these regulations. A waste is not what you think it is. And it turns out a waste is something that's being stored, you know, with the intent of disposing it later or whatever, or just being stored in lieu of disposal. A different kind of definition. Everything was so technical, it drove me crazy. And so, but the next time I got a hazardous waste case, you know, I was much more up on it. So having that institutional knowledge, having somebody there to show me what to do on it, very complicated areas. And our judges, when we bring our cases, they typically, I think it was mentioned before, they haven't seen this kind of case before or rarely. So they're looking to us for exactly what do we got here? And they rely on us to give them the straight story and explain it, you know, in a coherent, you know, appropriate way.
That's an excellent point. Way. Yeah, that's an excellent point. You know, environmental crime encompasses a heck of a lot more than wildlife crime. And Dennis, I will say that if you want to understand how complicated the law is that you guys deal with, you only need to walk into Dennis's office. I have never seen a more precarious situation of an impending paper avalanche.
Not anymore.
No.
Oh, I've got two witnesses here. How does my desk
look? No, it's still bad. It's still bad.
No, my desk is
It's been cleaned slightly, but it's no longer hazardous waste. Now it's
clean. Every night I clear it off. There's not a thing
I'm telling you.
Matt will tell you.
I've sat in his office at night while we're preparing for trial between 2 6.5 foot tall piles of paper, wondering when they're going to collapse on me. But I will say, if I ask you for, where's that document? You know which pile the document is.
I changed that. It's been, it clean now.
I believe it when I see it, Dennis.
Anytime.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Oh, every night I clear it off.
Okay, Mark, closing thoughts, huh?
I mean, look, I feel like I have the greatest job in the world. I get to come to work with great colleagues and work with great agents. I think there's a misnomer out there when you say you prosecute environmental crimes that you're like a, you know, hippie, Greenpeace, tree hugger, not to disparage any of those organizations, but that's really not what we are. You know, we're talking about prosecuting the worst of the worst, you know, massive toxic waste. You know, these aren't technical offenses. These are like really horrible situations involving forest fires that have burned down people's houses or, you know, had oil spills that have killed animals and closed businesses because people can't go to the beach. So businesses go under. You know, we've worked toxic waste cases where houses around dumps or, you know, have people that are literally throwing up every day.
Right.
You know, these aren't technical violations. These are really important cases. And, you know, we get to advocate for victims and, you know, do the best cases out there. So, you know, like I said, I feel lucky to work with these guys. And I think they said it best when they said that our section does the widest variety of cases in the office. And I think that's right. But I would also add that I think we do some of the most important cases in the office.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, going back to the case that I mentioned about the dive boat, you know, when you have a captain out there who takes 33 passengers out and all of them die in a fire on the boat, that's a bad case. We're going to get involved and prosecute that case. Mm-hmm. You know, we've charged the Palisades fire case, which is ongoing now.
Right.
You know, over 6,000 structures burned.
Right.
You know, we've charged, Matt charged the Orange County oil spill case that impacted all kinds of businesses and wildlife and other things. And that's what DOJ should be doing. You know, right. The worst cases involving a lot of loss and a lot of victims, and that's kind of what we do every day as our job. So,
yeah, the tough cases.
Appreciate you having us on, too. Yeah. You were really a tremendous agent to work with over the years. I mean that. I learned a ton from you.
Yeah.
You were a seasoned agent when I was just a baby AUSA, learning the ropes. You were very patient with me when I didn't know what the Lacey Act was, even though I closed it and never looked at it again after you studiously instructed me about the multiple steps. I thought, that's interesting. I'll deal with that. But mental your undercover note. Abilities were second to none.
Thank you.
Still use a lot of your cases as teaching tools for agents.
Awesome.
About how to identify a problem and proactively address that problem. Not just wait until the animal comes in through the port, to know there's a problem out there and to go out there and do something about it. And that's what you did as an agent. And I think it was just really great working with you over the years. So appreciate you having us on.
Well, thank you very much. That means everything to me because, you know, I was going to say in closing too that I always so appreciated the professionalism at the U.S. Attorney's Office and the ability to work with you guys on tough issues and, you know, debate and argue with and maintain our good relationships. It was always a pleasure to try to do public good working with you guys. And for people who do not tune in on this YouTube channel for Nature's Secret Service, just to give you a sense, you know, I'm talking to three very straight-laced, suit-wearing federal prosecutors, just what you would expect to see and who you would hope to be working the hard cases on your behalf. So thank you for all the work you guys do, and thank you for coming on the show. It's going to be a great episode, and I'll definitely have all three of you back together or individually, whatever you want.
Sounds good.
All right. Great. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. It's been a great season. Be sure to be back for season 3 and watch the website for updates about bonus episodes, shorts, and the premiere of season 3. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. Nature's Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturessecretservice.com.